We're starting a show now called The Mystic Pete Chronicles, and I'm Mystic Pete. Every week, through interviews with thought leaders, visionaries, and creatives, and stories, music, and humor, we'll do some deep ponders in this time of great change, and have some fun. If you'd like more information about today's guests, or to be interviewed for the show yourself, I'm at mysticpete.com. In today's show, we feature a story by the extraordinary Mike Bone called The Barn Bib Skate Arena. And I do an extended interview with Dr. Dan Wilson with Debunk the Funk. Also, music by Epicur, Joyride. Stay tuned.
The gray and green metal building at 5335 Hawkinsville Road, Macon, Georgia, started out as the Silver Blades Ice Skating Rink. Silver Blades was owned and operated by a notable real estate investor in Bibb County. To quote an old friend of mine, only Yankees went ice skating. Silver Blades was purchased out of bankruptcy by Mr. Franklin Pierce Davenport in 1956 for less than $20,000. We all called him Mr. D. It was Mr. D's sister, Helen Davenport, that came up with the original idea of putting in the hardwood flooring and converting the ice skating rink to a roller skating rink. Bingo! The barn was born. Mr. D may have given the location the lofty name the Bibb Skate Arena, but everyone I knew called it the barn. There was a demand for roller skating in Macon. There was a history of roller skating rinks in Macon. Roller skating was offered at Durs Lake and Lakeside Park, but their rinks were much smaller than the barn. The barn opened for roller skating business in 1957. Because of the location had been an ice skating rink, there were existing boys and girls toilets, a ticket office, a snack bar, and racks for storing skates. There was no need for major capital investment to convert the building from an ice skating rink to a roller skating rink. Initially, it was not large, about 5,000 square feet for the skating area, and all of the flooring was laid straight across the entire length of the skating floor. When the skaters got to the end of the skating floor to make their turn, it was like skating across a washboard. Your skates actually made a rumbling noise when you skated perpendicular to the wooden flooring strips. In 1962, the barn was closed for renovation. I thought my life had ended. My social life did end for a few months. A newer, lower-roofed metal addition was added to the barn. The area of the skating surface was increased from 5,000 square feet to 20,000 square feet. The Cincinnati Flooring Company was retained to install a new roller skating surface that featured a rotunda floor. A rotunda floor is constructed so that the hardwood flooring is curved at the ends. The oak flooring strips actually follow the direction of the skater's wheels. No more skating perpendicular to the flooring. No more washboard skating surface. No more rumbling skates at the corners. We were in roller skating high cotton when the barn reopened. Mr. D actually lived at the roller skating rink. He had a two-bedroom, two-bath apartment constructed above the old building with windows that looked out onto the skating floor. He was not an absentee business owner. Parents were allowed inside free to watch their kids skate. I remember the cost for an evening of skating was 50 cents plus 25 cents for a skate rental. That price increased to $5 for skating and $1 for a skate rental by the time the barn closed. Where else could parents drop off their kids for an evening for 75 cents and know that they were going to be well cared for? It was the cheapest babysitting service on record. The barn offered a wholesome evening activity for 4 hours for 75 cents. Three generations of Middle Georgians have glided around those oak floors on roller skates. Mr. D had a list of teenage commandments painted in black and white that hung in the ticket office. Here are some of them. Don't let your parents down. They brought you up. Choose a date who's fit for a mate. Don't go steady until you're ready. There were seven more of these wonderful suggestions for life. Boys only skates, girls only skates, couples only skates, anything to make roller skating interesting, inclusive, and different. In an effort to encourage some interaction between boys and girls and to bring out the shy children, there was a flashlight skate. The boys would stand in the middle of the rink and the girls would stand around the edge. One by one, the boys would tell the man with the flashlight who to point his beam of affection toward, and the couple would then start around the rink. Later in the evening, the roles would be reversed. The girls would stand in the middle and the boys would stand around the edge. If a couple skated both of these skates together, they might as well move in together. They were practically engaged. It was at the boys' choice flashlight skate that I proclaimed my love for Marcia Middlebrooks, and she reciprocated 30 minutes later at the girls' choice skate. We were in the fifth grade. Ah, young love. Music was an integral part of roller skating. Mr. D had a large collection of 45 RPM singles that he played on a phonograph connected to the sound system inside the rink. The collection was constantly updated with the latest hits. A record needed a certain rhythm to make roller skating around the rink fun. All the girls liked Marcy Blaine's Bobby's Girl and Shelley Fabre's Johnny Angel. The boys liked more up-tempo record. The Beach Boys' 409 was cause for the boys to skate really fast. Most girls wisely left the skating floor for the length of 409. The music determined what was happening on the dance floor. Truth be told, Mr. D was the first person to ever pay me money for music. I was 17 years old and managing a local Macon band called the Celtics. He paid the Celtics $35 to perform at a Saturday night sock hop at the barn. He paid them $50 for the second performance. I tried to convince the band it was because of their superior management that they got a $15 raise. It was at the barn skating event that my mom fell and broke her tailbone, her coccyx. It was painful for her and a source of amusement for my dad, my brother, my sister, and me. Mom's broken tailbone was a source of family jokes around the Thanksgiving dinner table for decades. There was a snack bar at the barn. It sold the normal selection of M&M's, Baby Ruth's, Snickers, popcorn, etc. I remember the hot dogs were part of the selection. The best part was the rainbow drink. Soft drinks were served from a fountain. If you ordered a rainbow, you got a little orange, a little Dr. Pepper, a little 7-Up, a little grape, and a little Coca-Cola, hence the name Rainbow. There was always a young adult man, older than the normal roller skaters, who skated when I was skating there. He was not from the neighborhood, but he was an amazing roller skater. He had his own black precision roller skates, and he used them with great effect. Men's skates, black. Women's skates, white. He would skate strong and fast, forward and backward. Everyone else was roller skating in an elongated circle, and he was roller skating in a giant figure eight. Most of the skaters started skating regularly about age 5 and stopped at about age 18 once they started dating and had access to an automobile. This guy was probably 25 or 30 years old. I never saw him with a woman, but man, he could roller skate. He rarely spoke to the kids. He would interact with Mr. D and occasionally help with the flashlight skate or teach someone to skate backwards, but he mostly kept to himself and roller skated. He never took a break. He never went to the snack bar. He was just gliding across the oak floor like he was a million miles away. There might have been 125 kids on the skating floor, but for him, the floor was vacant. We were all roller skating for entertainment. Roller skating was more of a spiritual activity for him. In 1965, Macon High Schools were integrated. The Barn was integrated a few years later. Sadly, the Barn is now just a memory. For my mom, it was a giant pain in her butt. But for a lot of people my age in Middle Georgia, it was a magical place. I guess this is called progress. Yeah.
Mystic Pete here. It is September 12, 2021. I have on the line Dr. Dan Wilson. He's a PhD. He has a YouTube channel called Debunk the Funk and also on Instagram, Debunk the Funk. And I've been following his work because he's, a truth teller and getting the word out about important health matters. And I wanted to put you on radio. Hi, Dr. Dan Wilson.
Hey, Pete. I'm happy to be here.
Why don't we get going by you explaining your credentials? What qualifies you to talk about this?
I got my PhD from Carnegie Mellon University, and my PhD was in molecular biology. While I was in grad school, I studied hardcore molecular biology topics, but not virology or epidemiology. However, I've always been really passionate about science communication. I've always tried to take it upon myself to learn about topics that are really important to the public. Carl Sagan once said that the society is exquisitely dependent on science technology, but hardly understands anything about science and technology. I started my YouTube channel as a way to kind of exercise this passion that I have in science communication. I started it originally just covering some anti-vaxxers that I was familiar with, and this was before COVID really got started. And then COVID got started, and with it came this huge wave of misinformation and confusion, which I think demonstrates really perfectly what Carl Sagan was trying to say, because now we have this imminent situation of a pandemic, and people need to understand that it's important to care about it and it's important to do something about it. But even that message has been muddled and confused. So I'm just a normal scientist who does his best to understand the data, and I try my best to communicate it in ways that not only is understandable, but also directly addresses some conspiracy misinformation claims that I see out there.
Fair enough. And just to be clear about conflict of interest, are you receiving anything, money or anything else that's related to anything we're going to talk about today?
No, I do this all on my own free time. It's like a weekend project for me.
You're not benefiting by getting this information out. And I know a lot of the people in the conspiracy community, they all have something they're selling. They're selling products and they'll benefit from the kind of garbage information they're putting out. But why don't we start at the beginning and you just talk for a while about some of the basics. Let's get that out of the way. And we're gonna be telling some truth here. Here it is, Dr. Dan Wilson.
Yeah, so I think that throughout this entire pandemic, it's been really complicated, right? Normally what happens in science is over the course of months or years, scientists in their own respective labs will do experiments. They're all interested in getting to truth. So they'll do experiments, they'll make observations, they'll gather data, they'll have lab meetings, they'll argue about it, and they'll eventually publish papers. And usually it's the papers that we see at the end of that process as the general public. And even then, the message gets kind of confused sometimes from paper to news source. But now what we're seeing is the whole scientific process played out publicly. So at the beginning of the pandemic, there were some things that we might have thought were true, but they were really just speculations. And scientists mostly understood this, but communicating that to the general public was difficult. The masks thing, which is a big issue in schools now, is started off this way, just confusing messaging, where at first scientists genuinely thought, well, we might not really need masks. previous SARS viruses typically would only spread well once the person has symptoms, and we knew that in a pandemic, we would need to conserve resources for our medical staff, our healthcare workers. But that all kind of changed when we figured out that SARS-CoV-2 can spread either pre-symptomatically or asymptomatically. So before you even develop any symptoms, or if you never develop any symptoms even, you can still spread it. That combined with the rising case numbers really changed scientists' perception on how useful masks would be in this pandemic. But when that messaging changed, it confused a lot of people, and it still does to this day, to the point where now we're absolutely sure that masks are very important for helping control the pandemic, but people don't want children who are too young to be vaccinated and are going to be soon gathering in schools every day. People don't want them to wear masks because they're confused on the science. And that's been really frustrating for me to see over and over again, how people just revive these dead myths that masks don't work and they change their mind and all these things. And in reality, it's just we reacted to the data. We reacted to data that showed us that masks are going to help. And so that's why the recommendation changed early on, but that still hasn't gotten through to people.
You know, what's curious to me is the forces that want to undermine science latch on to any little variance or change that the CDC or WHO or the government makes. Any little mistake gets blown up into this big storm. When we're dealing with an unknown thing, this is deadly, it's confusing, we're figuring out as we go along. Of course there's going to be little mistakes, of course there's going to be changes, of course. But the scientists have to be absolutely perfect all the way along. They can't make any revised judgment. But anyway, this all is used as ammunition to say, see, it's been a con all along, and it's unreasonable. Science doesn't work that way. We're facing something that's monstrous and problematic and confusing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, science is a journey to better knowledge. It's not something that just exists and scientists know it right away. You know, we have to figure these things out. And SARS-CoV-2 was a new virus. And we were doing the best we could at the beginning of the pandemic by saying, well, this is how previous SARS virus have behaved. So, you know, maybe this one is going to behave the same way. And we quickly found out that we were wrong. And so that's part of the process. But yeah, people like to latch onto that and say, oh, look, scientists have no idea what they're talking about.
Small mistakes and small corrections, of course, as we learn more about this mysterious new disease. Mm-hmm.
And with the masks thing, it's wild to me that people will point to that and say, see, masks don't even work. When that was never a contentious issue. The issue was always, you know, should widespread mask wearing be recommended? It was never an issue of whether or not they work. I mean, even your mother growing up would tell you to cover your mouth when you cough. It's really common sense, if I'm going to use that phrase. But, you know, we don't have just common sense at this point. We have so much data showing that people who are shedding infectious virus shed a lot less when their face is covered with even a cloth mask. Even a cloth mask is good at reducing the amount of infectious virus that you spread.
Fair enough. Now let's move on to, let's get even more controversial here. Let's dig into the whole vaccine issue. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. Yeah. So this has been, from a scientific standpoint, this has been such an interesting, exciting time for vaccines. But on the other side of the spectrum, you know, looking at it from just a layperson or someone in the general public, I can totally see how it would be really confusing. I mean, people are told that it normally takes 10 years to develop and approve a new vaccine. The reality is it takes closer to 20 to 30 years, but they don't get told why it takes that long. It gives this false impression of it takes that long because you have to do a lot of testing. And that's not really why it takes so long to develop and approve new drugs. It takes a long time mostly for one word, and that's money. Because what normally happens is if you have the science figured out and all you need to do is make a product, test it, and approve it, you have to go through a lot of steps. You have to first raise funds to do preclinical trials, which is where they would test the product on animals, determine various aspects of how it works, how safe it is, how well it works. And then once those data are gathered, then they have to wrap that up and submit it to the FDA. And the FDA will say, yes, this looks good. Now move on to phase 1 clinical trials. So that review takes time. And then once they get the answer back, they have to raise funds, you know, find the funding again for a phase 1 clinical trial. And once that's done, the process is repeated for phase 2 and phase 3. And each phase is more involved with more resources, more people. So it takes a long time to go through that whole process. But with COVID vaccines, that wasn't an issue. This was a huge problem that so many different bodies, so many different resources came together at once to tackle. So all of the funding and all of the priority for the review process and so forth was there for COVID vaccines. So the second that phase 1 clinical trials were done, the FDA would, boom, review it real fast. Not because they were rushing, but because it was prioritized. And they immediately had money, because it was so well funded, to move on to the next phase. So it's exciting to me as a scientist because it shows us what science can do when these kinds of projects have the kind of funding and attention that they need. It shows us that we can really make fantastic, effective new drugs really fast. And that's encouraging. That's exciting.
Scientists and most people seem to realize that this is some kind of miracle drug. You know, this is in the realm of when they discovered antibiotics or aspirin, or like basic miraculous science that helps a tremendous amount of people. And I'm looking at a news post right now. It says unvaccinated people are 11 times more likely to die of COVID than those who've gotten vaccines. So with this overwhelming information that this is like a wonderful medicine, how did this turn into some kind of anti thing? How? I don't understand it. A big question.
The best I can do to understand it, the best answer I can give, is that for so many people who are anti-vaccine, it's more about this idea that the government is trying to control them than it is about the science. I think the science comes secondary to them. They just eat up the misinformation about the science that supports their initial concern, which is that the government is trying to control them in whatever way a vaccine might allow them to control them.
So it's fear of government. That's what's driving all this. Fear of somebody else making decisions for you.
With my interaction with the anti-vaccine conspiracy circles, that seems to be the major concern, is that they just don't trust government.
And even if the alternative is dying alone, drowning in your own fluids in your lungs on a respirator in a hospital, dying a horrible death, even if that's the alternative.
Yeah, that's it, it's, I mean, you hear stories of people sticking to this belief even as they are put on a ventilator in a hospital. And I don't know how many of your listeners know or have some idea what it's like to be put on a ventilator, but it's, I mean, I've never experienced it, but it just looks like a really horrible and uncomfortable situation by all accounts.
Well, you have to be put under, and you have a machine. Well, there's a ball, I guess, stuck down your throat, and
yeah,
a machine starts breathing your lungs for you. Like one of the most uncomfortable things you can imagine. You have to be sedated because you will freak out. So you're unconscious, and this thing is trying to breathe your lungs in and out. And so it's awful. And it's just, once you get on that, not a good chance of survival.
Yeah, but I think that we do hear stories of people sticking to that their beliefs as they get put on a ventilator. But also before that, before they even get to a ventilator, I think a lot of people, you know, because they don't trust the government, they initially don't believe that COVID is a big deal. And that is a sentiment that appeared really early in the pandemic. You know, oh, it's just the flu. It's no worse than a flu. They're inflating the death counts. It has such a high survival rate. All of those things have been said for a very long time. And they're all either just wrong or extremely misleading. The people who don't experience the ventilator for themselves, they are partially driven by this misconception that COVID is not a big deal. And the reality is that it's a huge deal. I mean, just in the US, if people are still saying that it's no worse than the flu, there's no other way to put it than these people just have their head in the sand. Because what we see in reality is that in the span of just about a year and a half now, in the US, COVID has killed more people than the past 10 flu seasons combined. So that is just, it's calling it no worse than the flu is just ridiculous. Some people might say, oh, well, they're inflating the death numbers, they're faking tests to make it look like there are more people dying than there really are, they're faking the criteria for the death, blah, blah, blah. All that stuff is said. But without addressing each of those points individually, I can just tell you that fine, if you want to accept all of those things, or you don't care to like fact check them, all you have to do is look at the excess deaths. So every single year, most countries in the world will record the total number of deaths that occur within a year. So excess deaths in the case of COVID, is when we compare deaths in the year of 2020 or so far in 2021 to a 5-year baseline average. And when we do that, for whatever country, it's always a consistent message. It's that wherever there's a lot of COVID, there's a lot of excess death. Sometimes even more than the official COVID death count. And it's widely agreed by epidemiologists that this excess death method of counting deaths is a more accurate measure of the impact of a pandemic than the quote-unquote official death count. Because it doesn't rely on testing. It doesn't rely on the way deaths are reported. It just looks at the overall impact that the pandemic has had. And like I said, it's just very consistent across countries. The U.S. has a massive increase of excess deaths. Other afflicted countries, such as Brazil, UK, even Sweden, have excess deaths. Whereas countries like New Zealand, which squashed the pandemic pretty well, they had a negative excess death figure relative to that five-year baseline. So the numbers really just don't lie. COVID is a huge deal, and if you don't care about it, it's going to spread through your community, and it's going to affect either you or someone you love eventually.
So if you bury your head in the sand, sooner or later, you or someone you love is going to suffer terribly because of this misinformation, denial, ignorance. I'm having a very cheery conversation with Dr. Dan Wilson. You can find him on YouTube, Debunk the Funk, also on Instagram, Debunk the Funk. I understand it as actually two streams happening. One is people get scared. They see a post, they see a meme. Somebody is spreading a rumor, and they repeat the rumor. They repost the meme. They continue on with the nonsense. And then they get attacked, and people say, "You're an idiot." And then there's this like pride issue happening. I see this happen over and over, this doubling down. People just take this position that's fear-based, they get attacked, and then they double down. Now they're invested. Now they're representing that cause. Now it becomes a crusade for them because they've already aligned with this position, and now their ego is involved. Well, okay, well, now I'm twice and three times as convinced, and I see people get led into these extremist, as I say, crusades. Mm-hmm. How did this happen to you? But because they get attacked by normal common sense people expressing their views, and it radicalizes these people. And so that's one quadrant. And then I think there's also a real evil quadrant, a real sinister quadrant. They're making money off of supplements or new age this and that or coaching program. They're making money off of people getting suspicious and questioning the pandemic. So those people are real sinister. They're really into the evil world where they're benefiting at the expense of others. And there's even more evil people who, you know, they're just trying to sow chaos in the United States, other countries that see this as an opportunity to divide us, to conquer us. Any thoughts about my long-winded analysis?
Yeah, I have been asked before when it comes to the people I debunk on my channel, for example, been asked, why do you think these people do it? Do you think that they really believe it themselves? Or, like, what's up with them? And I think that what you said definitely comes into play. I think that either what happens is that these people have some experience in their lives and they get entrenched in these kinds of ideas. They build a community around it, their community gets criticized, called idiots. And then they rally as a community to say, no, you're the ones who are wrong. And it becomes an us versus them thing. And they just get deeper and deeper into it. I think that's definitely a part of it. But like you said, there are definitely some people who almost certainly know better. They know exactly that what they're saying is garbage, that it's not correct. But they say it anyway because they have a Patreon account, they're making tons of money off of their views, their fan base is just eating up what they say.
So they're fear parasites. They're making money by scaring people.
Exactly, exactly. There are several individuals who have become prominent during the pandemic who I can think of as being just that. One who comes to mind who isn't so popular in the mainstream, but I've had some fun with him on my channel, is I won't name his name, but it's a guy who basically believes that SARS-CoV-2 doesn't exist, that viruses in general don't exist. Really, really wacky. I was blown away when I first found him. I was like, really? This guy? How do you believe that? So I had some fun.
Flat Earth people, basically.
Yeah, flat Earth of the biology world is what I call them. But you know, when it comes to somebody who doesn't believe that viruses exist, I go straight to this realm of this idea of like, okay, well, seeing is believing, right? If you can see something, then it exists. And I did a lot of work with structural biology during my PhD. And with structural biology, you literally make molecules visible. And so when it comes to viruses, we can literally see the SARS-CoV-2 virus in such extraordinary detail that you can see the sequence of amino acids that make up the proteins on its outer shell. And, you know, I was talking to some of my science friends about this in the context of this guy who just denies that viruses exist. And we were like, what if we just get on one of his webinars? Because he offers these webinars where he charges his audience, I think it's like, oh God, I think I paid like $20 to listen to him talk for like an hour and a half on a webinar. It was ridiculous. But we were like, what if we get on one of his webinars and just ask a question and we're able to like confront him in front of his audience? And we're like, yeah, that would be fun. I mean, we could at least try. I don't know if he'll call on us or we'll get to ask our question, but whatever, let's do it. What ended up happening was me and one of my friends, who's also a scientist, we were in the chat in this webinar. We were waiting to ask a question in the Q&A section. My friend gets picked, and somehow, I don't know what the admins were doing in this webinar, but they make him an admin accidentally. And so normally you wouldn't be able to share your screen as you ask a question, but somehow they made him an admin and he was able to share his screen. And so he got to put up a picture, one of those pictures of the SARS-CoV-2 virus in high resolution, and say, you know, what is this? How do you explain this? And it was glorious. I caught it all on camera, made a video about it. And, you know, we tried to also be honest about it. We tried to say like, hey, you know, if you want to really talk to us, guy giving the webinar, we're willing to debate you, on whatever forum you want, or just talk about this. So his response was to try to file a copyright claim against my videos, which didn't work, but, that was his response. He never tried to talk to us. He just wants to make money off of his webinars, which, if I remember right, off of that webinar alone, with the number of people there, I calculated that he made something like $18,000 just off one webinar.
Now we're into the more evil doers.
Exactly.
This is just sinister. And the thing is, the true believers involved, even if they're not making money, they don't care about facts. They're convinced of their own position for the fact that they already believe it. So that's proof enough. So, yeah, okay. It's kind of an uphill battle when you have people who are just, they have it on faith from God. They know in the marrow of their bones that what they're saying is correct. Damn the truth and the facts, and to hell with science. But anyway, let me get into one last issue here, and I'd like to hear what you have to say about this. Is maybe a little bit of a devil's advocate position. Mm-hmm. This is complicated, but it's important that this issue be addressed. So let's just take this one. The pharmaceutical companies have been known for doing some just awful, awful things. So, you know, the anti-vax people are attacking, you know, Big Pharma. In truth, Big Pharma has done some horrible, horrible things. They've done some really good things, like make these vaccines, but then they've done things like create the big opioid crisis. Now, I understand the Sackler family and Purdue Pharmaceuticals are getting, you know, they're having to pay some billions of dollars to the states because they've killed or destroyed hundreds of thousands of people's lives and destroyed whole communities. The Sackler family is going to walk away with billions of dollars even after these fines, and that's all a businessman needs to know, that when all is said and done, no matter how many people die, do I walk away with more money? And they are. And in some respects, everything they did was kind of legal. You know, they're finding way. And nobody's going to jail for killing all the people because of the opioid overdoses. Nobody's going to jail. So you have this really kind of diabolical thread within corporate medical companies. This is maybe the most egregious example. I'm not trying to argue for them or against that. I'm just saying they have a history, many, many examples of real corrupt behavior that's hurt people, and a history of like doing wonderful things. What I'm getting at is there's this suspicion because so much money is involved. How do we trust the people making our miracle drugs, our medicine, when they have such a complicated and corrupt history? That's what I'm getting at. Please help me and help the audience make sense of this. What do we do about this really rough situation?
Whenever I debunk these things, whenever I make a video on my channel debunking a topic, I come at it from a perspective of I understand why these ideas are so popular, why these ideas exist. But I try to add some nuance that tries to add some insight into why we know that these vaccines are effective. So it's absolutely true that pharmaceutical companies have done terrible things and are, you know, have a lot of blood on their hands for the opioid epidemic, like you mentioned. But they've also created very life-saving drugs like insulin.
Yes.
And so you can't just point to one or a handful of examples and say, see, that represents the entire industry. They only want to make money. They're just evil and out to deceive us and make as much money as they can. When in reality, there are lots of things that are saving a lot of people's lives on a daily basis that come from pharmaceutical companies. So as a scientist, you're forced to take it case by case. You can't make blanket statements about the intentions of an entire industry and use that to judge whether or not you're going to take a new medicine or a drug or a vaccine. you have to do your best to understand the data. And, you know, if you're a lay person and you don't have time to really get into the weeds and you're hearing all of these seemingly conflicting things, you know, I encourage you to just listen to more scientists, listen to more scientific communicators who really try hard to explain the science to people. And the feeling you'll get if you do that is that these vaccines are very safe and very, very effective. One thing to remember here is that, yes, pharmaceutical companies are a business, and one of their goals is to make money. But with something as high profile as COVID-19, if they put out a bad product, they're not going to make money. So they do have an incentive to put out a product that's actually going to be effective and be safe. Because if they don't do that, then, well, scientists are going to call them on it. And if the data don't back them up, then they're not going to get very far, and they'll be billions of dollars in the hole, because that's how expensive it is to run these clinical trials. And companies like Pfizer did mostly fund their own clinical trials themselves. Another aspect of this is that if their only goal is to make money, they wouldn't be wanting to make vaccines. The reason is that if you think about taking a vaccine, you get a limited number of doses, right? It starts out with a 1 or 2 dose regimen. Maybe you need a booster. But if they wanted to make a drug that treats COVID instead of a vaccine that prevents COVID, instead what we'd end up with is a pandemic where the virus is constantly transmitting, because we're not preventing it. It's constantly transmitting. We're constantly getting cases. We're constantly getting people rushed to the hospital or wanting to treat it at home themselves. So if the pharmaceutical companies have a drug that they can sell you, they're going to make tons of money off of that over a longer period of time. So really, if their only goal is to make money, they just wouldn't be making vaccines. But part of their goal is to make an effective product that is going to save lives. And so that in part is why we have these vaccines now. So I hope that makes sense to the audience, that if you're treating something instead of preventing it, you're definitely going to make a lot more money on it. I mean, just look at your bill when you get your vaccine, which is free, versus your bill when you leave a hospital, which is enormous. So all that money that you pay after leaving a hospital, a lot of it's going to pharmaceutical companies, because the hospitals need to replace their supplies and the drugs they used to treat you while they had you. So it's really not black and white. I understand that there are concerning things about pharmaceuticals history, but when you look at the whole picture and really think about what's going on and the approach that pharmaceutical companies are encouraging people to take by taking these vaccines, it really doesn't fit with this idea that they're evil, money-hungry machines, that they're nothing but evil, money-hungry machines that just want to make as much money as they can without caring about the health of their customers.
I think you make some important points, but to expand the conversation, what I think we need to do is orient pharmaceutical companies to reduce the bad and increase the good. I mean, it's kind of obvious, right? And yeah, the only way that's going to happen is if money is removed from the equation. money just has this. I'm probably the first person who ever thought of this, that money is corrupting, right? Well, you know, yeah. The pharmaceutical companies spend their money on hair loss products, on Viagra-like products, things they'll make a lot of money on, and not so much on infectious disease products. We need to have a systemic reform, particularly in this area. It's just not so capitalistic, and it's more oriented towards benefiting people. And what are the kind of medications that are really going to help people? And then I think overall, when drug companies get a reputation of being better people and not such greedy people, people will trust them more. When a pandemic comes along and they say, we have this great vaccine, they'll have a better reputation. So I think that is the long-term solution here. To that, whether it's through single payer healthcare or making medicine not for profit, you know, there's a lot of solutions here, but that's the long term solution. And
absolutely,
well, all right,
I totally agree.
Fair enough. Okay, good. We have come to agreement. You have said some very important information. I'm speaking with Dr. Dan Wilson. People can find you at Debunk the Funk on YouTube. A lot of interesting videos also on Instagram, Debunk the Funk. Dr. Dan Wilson, thank you very much for your time. We will talk again as things evolve. I know you have a lot more to say. Thank you so much for your time.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. It's a real honor.
The show called The Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. We started today's show with a story by the extraordinary Mike Bone called The Barn Bib Skate Arena. We also heard music by Epiker, Joyride, and an extended interview with Dr. Dan Wilson from Debunk the Funk. Thank you so much for listening. I'll be back next week. Mystic Pete out.